on end.
Yeah, well, I think the concept is to understand what meditation does at a scientific level. And meditation really has two core requirements that you're looking for it to achieve. The first thing is to gain balance in the mind, and the second thing is to increase awareness. And it's kind of like two muscles that you need to develop at the same time. My meditation teacher would describe it as two wings of a butterfly. If they're not equal in size and equal in shape, then the butterfly won't be able to fly. So it's very important first to understand what meditation does and how it works in order for it to work effectively for you. Once you understand that you're trying to develop balance and awareness, then what you're really doing is you're focusing your mind to a single point. And anybody who creates anything in life knows that what you focus on expands. And the more that you can focus on a single task, the more that task is going to expand. So the most successful people I know all have some form of meditation or contemplation that they do. You can call it a spiritual practice, but it's not really a spiritual practice. It's a practice of being able to focus all of your awareness on a single point without being distracted. And this is critically important to achieving any task in life. Not only that, when you meditate, I mean, meditation is nothing other than focusing on your breath going in and out of your nose. I mean, that's meditation. I mean, there's a million different ways of meditating, but if your viewers wanted to start right away, they could sit down and just focus on their breath underneath their nostrils. And there's only really three rules to meditation generally. Don't move at all, breathe naturally, and focus beneath your nostrils, and that's pretty much it. So if you can do those three rules, you can sit comfortably anywhere you like. Once you've found your posture, don't move, close your eyes, focus below the nostrils and just breathe naturally, well, then you're meditating. If you focus on your breath, though, what you're doing is you're bringing all of your awareness to the front of your mind, which means you're bringing all of the glucose that's going through your brain that allows you and assists you to think, you're bringing it to the front center of your actual brain, the prefrontal lobe. And this really is the area that we use for our decisiveness, for clarity, for clear-mindedness of thinking, and for ambiguity resolution. So when we're focusing through meditation all of the blood glucose to the front of our mind, we're helping the neural matter form new connections, which means we can think more rapidly and with more clarity. So meditators have a unique ability to think quickly and decide quickly. And they've said that the gauge of a successful person is that they can make decisions rapidly and they change them slowly. And unsuccessful people make decisions slowly and change them rapidly. So the more you meditate, the faster you will be able to clearly solve problems and make decisions in alignment with your intuition. So forgetting all the spiritual benefits and the health benefits, for example, when you're meditating, there's a hormone in your body that is the precursor for all the hormones, and it's called DHEA. I mean, that's the four-letter acronym for it. But DHEA is like the human steroid. It's the steroid that allows every other hormone in your body to continue to do what it needs to do. And when you meditate in absolute alignment for a period of up to 6 hours, they've shown that the production of DHEA can increase by as much as 100%. So there is extreme health benefits to meditation. There's the spiritual benefits of, you know, finding enlightenment and choosing your path and whatever other key words that they throw out there. From a business perspective or a wealth-generating perspective, the reason it's critical is you can solve problems more rapidly and you're far more decisive. So I recommend everybody should meditate at least 20 minutes a day, and generally in the morning, because if you start your day with that silence and that ability to focus for that 20-minute period, then the rest of your day is set on that frame. So I meditate the moment I wake up. I just open up my eyes, push myself up against the wall of the bedhead. I just sit there and meditate. I don't have a fancy cushion. I don't have a fancy room. I don't put in any fancy clothes or play any fancy music. I just sit down in my bed and I do the practice. And I've been doing this really since I was about 13, I think, was when I first learned how to meditate. And I studied a lot of different meditation practices, but at the end of the day, the simple things in life are often the best. And so just sit quietly and stay balanced and aware. And a balanced and aware mind is a mind that operates at its optimal frequency. And I don't know if your listeners or your viewers study a lot about brainwave frequencies, but there are frequencies of the brain that the mind goes through. There's delta, theta, there's alpha, there's beta, and then there's gamma. And these are speeds at which your brain oscillates. So delta is like a deep sleep, so 0 to 4 hertz per second. So that would be a delta wave frequency. Then you've got theta, which goes from a 4 to 14. Then you've got alpha that goes from about 14 to about, 20 or 24. And then you've got beta that goes from 24 up to about 40. Alpha goes from 14 to 40, and then beta goes from 40 up to about 70. Now, the concepts that we're looking for is as the brain speeds up and hits into what these gamma waves, it's when you're getting the optimal brainwave frequency occurring. And what they're finding, actually, I should just correct that, gamma waves are 40 cycles per second up to 70. Now, I know this is all a lot of jargon and numbers and whatnot, but how does it make you money? That's the most important thing you need to know. And I'll tell you how it makes you money. The optimal brainwave functioning is at 40 cycles per second. Now, meditators who've been meditating for a long time and have been able to get their mind to focus, what they found is their mind doesn't slow down, it actually speeds up. A lot of people think that meditation is slowing down the mind. That's actually incorrect. When you first start meditating, the mind will in fact slow down. In fact, sometimes you'll fall asleep, you'll go right into delta and you'll be out. But when you get better and better at balancing the mind and keeping it aware, the speed of your brain goes up in that 40 cycles per second, and that's when your brain operates at its absolute perfection. It's the perfect cycles for cognition. So, and that's where you can have insight and intuitive thought at its best. So there are too many scientific reasons that people should be meditating, and my advice to your listeners is check out the woo-woo, tree-hugging, incense-burning version of meditation, and then go and study some science behind why it actually works. And I've done some research into monks around the world, and I've attached these electrodes to their heads, and they get them to think about gratitude and contemplate the concept of gratitude, and sure enough, they hit these gamma waves, these 40 cycles per second, and this is a phenomenon across all these people who've been meditating for a long time. So it is the ability to speed the mind up and get it going at the optimum level.
Yeah, I like that because it's talking about, you know, your conscious and your unconscious and subconscious mind basically working in alignment. You spoke about gratitude. I tell my clients that, and I do it myself, that at the end of the day, I have a thing called a gratitude book where I write in it, today I'm grateful for whatever. And it just goes through a list. And some days you feel that you've been pushing the, what you might call it, uphill. But then I say, I'm grateful that I live in a house. I'm grateful that clean water comes out of the tap. And it starts shifting the perspective, which, like you talk about, gets the brainwave into the state of looking for more good things, even as you are asleep. Because I think a lot happens while we are supposedly asleep that in terms of problem solving still occurs. So do you do that list as well for like in terms of articulating what you are grateful for today?
Yeah, I definitely do when I can remember to. I don't do it every day, but I do often do it. I do it as regularly as I can remember. But what I normally do is when I go to sleep at night and I lie on the pillow, that's generally when I rattle off the things that I'm grateful for. So, you know, I can rattle off the fact that I'm just grateful for my pillow. I'm grateful for my blanket. I'm grateful for my bed. But I find that's a really great way to go to sleep because it really does set up the right, I guess, vibration for when you get up the next day. So I'm always looking for ways to remind myself of the things that I have that I often forget to be grateful for. And that's why I do love traveling quite a lot, because when you travel around the world, you get to see just how lucky we are to live in a country like Australia or to live in a country like America or to live in a, you know, any of these countries that have managed to experience a certain level of lifestyle. So it only takes a very short, quick trip to somewhere like Tanzania or any of these areas around Africa before you realize just how grateful you're allowed to be and just how many things you do have to be grateful for. So I do remember, because we've set up, we had the good fortune of setting up, assisting to set up an orphanage over in Tanzania, and there's just one moment that sticks in my mind when I was out visiting one of the villages and we're in his little shack there and he takes the lid off this 20-litre, like it's a plastic bucket container, like a paint drum, and he takes the lid off it and he scoops his cup in and he pulls out and he has a sip of water. And it was then that I realized that's their entire water supply is in this bucket, and that's where they do all their drinking from, their washing, their eating, everything. And it really, every time I turn a tap on now, I think of that moment. So any time I turn on a tap and out comes water, it just really truly reminds me just that we have infinite things to be grateful for, truly, if you live in Australia or any of these developed countries. And so I think it's very important to keep that attitude of gratitude, more so from a creation or an attraction perspective. People who are grateful are centered. So If you're centered and aligned, you're typically in a grateful state. You're not proud, you're not humble, you're sort of halfway between the two. So the more grateful you are, the more congruent you're going to be with the ideas that you'd like to create in life, because you're going to be more balanced and more centered. And gratitude is also another way of leading to meditation. It's another way of finding that centered point to create from. So absolutely, I'm a huge fan of gratitude. The benefits are endless as to what you can create with it.
Okay, I've got a question here for you, Ben. Now, you said at the start you were $130,000, $40,000 in debt. You were overweight, you were unhealthy, mentally not in a good place. People don't arrive on this earth like that, okay? Somewhere along the line, something happened. And what I'd like to know is a lot of it is, like you say, the programming that we get. So you would have had then some really negative messages about money and about self and so forth. So can you just share with us, because I think people will be interested in knowing, because they probably have had the same, I guess, negative messages thrown at them too. And you've talked about how you then got out of it, but just working through that spot, can you just share with us there?
Yeah, it's I love the quote that we're all born as originals, but most of us die as copies. And I think that's truly how it works. We lose our originality somewhere and we start to model people. So when it comes to finance, if I was to track back through everybody and really look through it all, well, where did I learn about finances? Well, the very first person that ever employed me was very bad with money, had no idea about business, had a failing restaurant, happened to be my uncle, and he was overweight. So what happened is, when I left school and finally became a valuable member of society and started to contribute and work, doing washing dishes, or I think they call it being a busboy over in America,
we call it a dish pig
here in Australia, a kitchen hand, that's it, that's a much more nicer title than dish pig, but that's what I was doing. I was earning about $6 an hour. And this is my first job, first paying job, first time I'd ever set a belief that I was valuable and worthy of something. So I'm looking at my uncle and the way he's managing his restaurant, I'm getting all the lessons I can. And he's overweight, he's always eating, the guy's smoking cigarettes all the time, he's really bad with money, he's borrowed all this money off everyone in our family, and he's going broke. And I'm learning that that's how to manage your money and how to eat your food. And so as I continue to work for this guy for 2 years, I start to form a belief around how you're meant to do things. In fact, it's been said that the very first person that ever gives you money, you're about 85% likely to earn the same income as them at some point in your life. It's really quite strange how we form this imprint and this belief around how we manage your money. My brother, on the other hand, he was fortunate enough. His very first job was working for a Taiwanese gentleman who was extremely wealthy, multimillionaire, many, many shops. He imported bicycles and a whole range of different things, and it only took my brother 2 to 3 years before he became a multimillionaire, had multiple shops, and he was up and running. So his model was clear, very wealthy, and he modeled it correctly. My model was not very good, and I modeled it spot on. And I did the same thing. I borrowed money off my family, borrowed money from banks. So that's really, I think, where I learned the bad behaviors. And then I really think depression is more of a gift than anything else. A lot of people harp on about how bad depression is. I think anyone who's been through it and comes out the other side can clearly see that depression only has one purpose in life, and it's to help you become your own best friend. That's really what it's designed for. The symptom is the cure. So depression, if you look at depression, you tend to get rid of all your friends. You hide away at home. You don't talk to anybody. But if you look at those symptoms are actually saying, please spend more time with yourself. That's what depression helps you do. It helps you spend more time with yourself until you're willing to fall in love with yourself. And so depression helps people find their value. And that's why people struggle with it for so long, because they don't realize that the way to get out of it is to start loving themselves. But the second you love yourself, the depression vanishes instantaneously. And I've had the good fortune of working with people who've had chronic depression, 6 years, 7 years, some cases even 25 years depression. And within a matter of minutes, 30, 40 minutes, it's gone permanently. Not some hypnosis trick, but just showing people what they can love about themselves, and it's gone. And so I guess the depression assisted me because even though I was modeling my uncle's wealth strategies, my uncle's eating strategies, my uncle's health strategies, I think you create your own depression so that you can say, wait a minute, Ben, it's time to wake up and start to value yourself and start to love yourself. And it took me 4.5 years to understand what it was teaching me. And then when I finally got, I remember it, I was sitting down on my couch one day and I tried everything. I tried to kill it with medication. I tried to yell at it and scream at it, and I'd been fighting this thing. And everyone's always told, fight your illnesses and fight your depression and all this weird stuff. The problem is when you fight stuff in your head, it just gets stronger because it's made out of energy. So the more energy you put on it, the stronger it's going to get. So you don't fight depression because it's just going to get more powerful. It's the most insane concept that a lot of people out there tell you to. Can you just tell me, what do you want? What are you doing in my head? Like, why are you occupying my space? And he just told me, he said, I'm here to teach you how to love yourself. And once I got the message, he walked out, and I never felt depressed ever again. And so it was a combination of factors of modeling the wrong people, but then creating a mental illness, so to speak, in my mind to assist me to get the understanding that I'm worthy of everything and anything this planet has to offer simply because I was born. And that's really how I formed my beliefs and how I broke them.
It's a form of self-parenting,
I'm trying to think of anyone else. It absolutely is, yeah. There's no two things about it.
You never got the, son, I'm proud of you from a parent, or maybe they were an absent parent or they were emotionally unavailable. You're going to be hanging out for that, and if you're not going to get it from them, you're going to be seeking it from other sources. And a clinician once told me that she said depression is anger turned inwards.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that everybody needs a rite of passage at some point, because the funny thing is if you really look inside, there's a great quote out there that says, we never truly grow up, we just learn how to act mature in public. So the fact is that we never get told that we're an adult. We never get told that we're allowed. And one of my mentors is a gentleman by the name of Dr. Wayne Dyer. And Wayne once was explaining this concept that he sat on his desk a little sign that simply said, I'm allowed. I'm allowed. And so when I heard this, I printed out this huge big poster with a red stop sign on it, and underneath it said, I'm allowed, and I stuck it on the back of my front door so that every time I walked out of my house, I reminded myself that I'm allowed. I'm allowed to do whatever I want. I'm allowed to grow a business. I'm allowed to take a day off. I'm allowed to finish at 2 a.m. I'm allowed to do whatever I want. I'm allowed to do it. And I only really check in with three questions. And the questions are, is it safe to me, safe to others, and safe to the planet? And if I get a yes to those three, then I'm allowed to do anything I want. And it's truly with all the, I've coached about 7,000 people now in one-on-one scenarios, and I have to tell you, the number one thing people need is permission. They need to give themselves permission to say, I'm allowed to do this. And permission is normally granted in tribal indigenous cultures through some type of rite of passage. You either go and kill a lion, or you go and spend, 4 weeks in the jungle and feed yourself, or for a Westerners, we have that gap year where we travel into Europe, get drunk for a whole 12 months, and if we come out alive, then we're an adult. And so we all have strange rites of passage, and quite often people will use depression as their rite of passage. As in, if they can pull themselves out of the depression, then they will become an adult. So I believe that one of the things that we do miss in our culture is some rite of passage. And if we were to give that to people, they would have far more self-worth because they would feel like they're an adult now. They'd feel like they don't need to be subordinate to anyone else's beliefs, and they'd really be able to go out there and create. But unfortunately, without an effective rite of passage, normally people are subordinating to a parent figure up until about the age of 45 or 50. And that's why you find about the age of 45 or 50, people have this huge value shift and they want to go out there and do what they love. But for a lot of them, they start to believe and convince themselves that it's too late now. But the reason that the majority of people transition into doing what they love around 45 to 50 is because they've finally released the belief that they're still a child, and they've finally owned the fact that they are, in fact, somebody who has the freedom to do anything that they want, that they're actually allowed to do those things.
Yeah, so on one hand, you have the people who say, this is a midlife crisis that Bob's going through because he's just ditched the wife and got himself a trophy blonde. And then you have at the other end...
Thank you, Harley.
and the Harley, and then you get the other end, somebody who sort of gets this almost like a realization, as though a bucket of water has been tipped on them, and they wake up from kind of the sleepwalking they've been going through for the past 45, 50 years, like you say. And do those people end up at your courses and they say, you know, Ben, I kind of know what I want to do. I'm scared shitless. Can you help me? So what is it that you say to them first up, besides write a list of 500 things?
I'm a big fan of the list. Absolutely. We do get a lot of our clients. If we look at our ideal client, they generally are female and around the age of about 45 to 55. And the reason that we look for them as the ideal client is because we work with difference makers. That's really who we're interested in working with. So people who do coaching, consulting, speaking training, online educating, or any type of product creation that makes a difference in people's lives. And that's really who our ideal target market is. And we find that women between the age of 45 and 55, when they have this value shift, this organic shift in values where they no longer have an identity of being subordinate to ideas and beliefs, or maybe they're no longer a mother, or they're still a mother, but the kids have transitioned out, they really connect in with their heart and they realize that life was really all about fulfillment and going out there and making a difference. And what I found the most fulfilling times that human beings can experience is when they're solving problems for people. So if you think about the most fulfilling day you ever have, it's the day you solve the most amount of problems. So people who are unfulfilled are people who don't solve problems. They don't have enough challenges in their life to make them fulfilled. So I love coaching and I love speaking because every day I'm solving problems. It's kind of a bit of a selfish career to go into coaching or assisting people because every single day you're solving multiple problems. And so once you fundamentally understand that this thing that everybody seeks, which is more fulfillment, can only be given by solving problems, then your duty in life is to solve as many problems as possible. And when people have this shift at around 45, they get it. They intuitively understand that they want to go out there and serve. They want to somehow make a difference in someone else's life because they know the feeling they've been missing their whole life is going to be found at the end of that problem. And so that's typically who comes to us. And then they do come petrified. They come in quite afraid. But we have really good systems to help them to accelerate that. And it's never too late. We've got clients that join us at the age of 75. We've got a lady who joined us once, she was 82. It's never too late to get that last bit of fulfillment in your life. You know, I truly believe that the right time is any time you're ready to go. It's not about being too old or too young or too tall or too short. It's about making a decision, saying today's the day that I live a fulfilling life and I'm worthy of it, I deserve it. And I think that's an important decision everyone should make.
Wow, that's powerful stuff. So where can they find you, Ben?
Just look into the camera. No, I'm kidding. you can find me on authenticeducation.com.au. So authenticeducation.com.au. And if any of your viewers or listeners are interested in finding out more, right on the homepage, we've actually got a full 60-minute audio program where I go through and interview a lady and I show you how I find what's meaningful to this lady, and I show you how I find her values and what we call her shadow values, which is years of research I've done into kind of the flip side of values. So if people are into values, this shadow values audio will be significantly different to anything they've heard before, but it will really give them an insight into how they can start to find their values. It's got some great questions in it, and some great ideas of how they can look for what's meaningful to them. So authenticeducation.com.au, and right on the homepage there's a free audio program that your viewers can download immediately.
Okay, so the shadow is I don't give a rat's about other people, is it? That's the shadow value.
Yeah, well, the shadow is the thing that we hide from strangers but show to the people we love the most. So quite often in life, the people that we love the most get the absolute worst of us, and people we've never met before get the best of us. And that's because we have this shadow, this thing that has certain values that drive it, things like the need for control, the need for attention, the need to belong, the need to feel superior, the need to be validated, the need for money. So quite often we hide in the shadows the things that we're ashamed and guilty about, but we know that we like. So everybody likes to be in control, but no one really likes to admit it, or not everyone likes to admit it. Everybody enjoys attention because that allows people to appreciate them, but not everybody likes to admit it. So we do put things into the shadow that we don't show society, And we always show society our golden self, you know, who we want society to perceive us as. And then when we get home behind closed doors, all of that shadow comes out and we offload that onto the people we care about the most, which makes no sense to me. I think we should be offloading our shadow onto the people we don't know and showing our best side to the people we love the most. But for some reason, we don't do it that way. We always put our worst on the people we love the most because we know that they're going to forgive us. And so that it's the saddest truth of society that the people that we care about and love the most will always get the worst of us. It's really quite strange how we operate. So the shadow is understanding how to get the shadow and work with it, and because the shadow is responsible for all of your driving force, truly. It's all those hidden values that when you access them and utilize them correctly, you can make them work for you. And really when you own them, it's quite liberating because you're not ashamed or guilty about the things that you value and how you get a result in your life.
Wow, that's really powerful stuff. So it's basically embracing every aspect of us because we're multifaceted creatures, and to deny one bit is to say that, or to put a judgment on it, basically. And I don't believe that. And you know, you've just sort of encapsulated it really, really well, Ben. I appreciate the time you spent with us and today. And so you people out there in blog TV, you know, in Stickum, you've got massive amount of value from this. Go contact Ben at authenticeducation.com.au, and I'm sure he can point you in the right direction. Just come with a long piece of paper.
And a few pens.
And 500 reasons why you're worth $20 million. And I think a lot of people will take you up on that challenge, and we'd love to get some feedback of you guys when you've done your 500 reasons. And we'll probably get you back, Ben, and have a chat once we get to know these people and their lists. So on behalf of everybody, thank you very much, Benjamin Harvey, for
thank you
very
so much for having me.
God bless.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Today's podcast is brought to you by ObesityHotline.com.